had worked. Now here they were, maybe a day too late, maybe not. Instead of four of Purcell's drinking buddies, it was only Quarles, and he looked like he'd been beaten with a hammer. Ford, standing at the starboard window, took all this as a bad sign. If the other men were afraid to be seen in the area, it was possible that Nickleby and the girl hadn't left the resort by choice, or even alive. The portal glass was thick. He couldn't hear the men talking, but could see that the exchange was becoming heated. The mailboat schedule went into his pocket when Quarles pointed at something, an obvious distraction. Ford was opening the door as the first punch was being thrown. By the time he got down, Purcell was on his back, dazed, and the dilapidated boat was moving. Quarles slunk behind the wheel as if scared.
"Hit me when I wasn't looking," the giant bawled. "God damn it, I warned them Haitian fools they was badass. Warned them all, but Quarles faults me for saying it would be easy."
Ford had to leave for Andros soon. He wrangled what there was to know about the Haitians before bothering to ask, "Warned them about who?" 10. Lydia was the first to notice the seaplane, how low it was flying, and wondered in a distracted way if someone was tailing them.
"Probably a crew shooting a commercial," Leonard said. "It's too rough to land out here, so go ahead, wave like a native. What are you afraid of? That they'll drop a bomb or something?"
Aboard the 70-foot freighter Fresh Moon, dozens of Bahamians lined the rail and waved wildly as the plane did a low pass. As it circled back, Leonard accepted an invitation to dance from two very large women. And why not? Everyone else was up moving to the beat of steel pots. It was a spontaneous hello to the pilot, a man alone in the cockpit, way out here in a desert of blue that had consumed many freighters, many small planes.
"They were celebrating life,"
Leonard said, grinning when the plane was gone. He plopped down on a box beside Lydia, a little out of breath. Looked like the pilot might have turned toward Donner's place. He said his island's east of Arthur's Town. She didn't want to discuss the man in white. Until last night she'd never met him, but knew his name was Ephraim Donner. He was a Hollywood film producer who had invested millions in Benthic. That loss was followed by a sex scandal, physical abuse or porn, she wasn't sure, yet there was the yacht and an island he'd bragged about, and he'd paid cash for their Spanish reales. Coincidental? Not likely. Lydia stuck to the subject of the plane, saying,
"I didn't see a camera. Why would the pilot pass so low? Maybe the guy didn't want to celebrate by himself, or..."
A smile came into the professor's eyes. "He wanted a closer look at the most beautiful woman in the islands.
Know what you should have done? Flashed him. Really. Give the poor bastard a nice long look. Share the bounty, I say, but not the salvage rights. Get it?"
God. Sometimes he was so damn cute it was hard to keep a straight face. "He wasn't flying that low, Professor.
That's not the way I remember those twin rapiers of yours, so time for another inspection. How about we stand watch in our cabin?"
They'd already stood watch in their cabin twice since departing the resort 10 hours ago. It was a tiny metal closet, no sink or toilet, just bunks that folded out of the wall. Better, much better, up here on deck, despite an old tractor and a couple of cars secured with chains and mounds of cargo. The middle deck was to be avoided altogether. It smelled of livestock, chicken hutches and caged pigs en route to market. Goats were tethered there, too. At the rear of the ship was the bridge. The structure was 2 stories tall, a cocoon of rusted steel that was the domain of the captain, a tiny man in his 70s with a big smile beneath a cap festooned with gold braid.
"Isn't this air wonderful?" Lydia said, to change the subject.
It was Leon who responded by extending his hand.
"The air will be just as nice after we finish inspection, Lady Anne."
In the months leading up to their escape, they'd plotted like kids building a secret treehouse. Fake IDs required fake names, but not any name would do. The sound had to be similar, or they might not respond when a stranger called to them. Homophonic was the term Prof. Nickleby, who was still employed at the time, had used. Lydia had become Lindy, or Linda Ann, and, when it felt right, Lady Ann. All a playful tribute to a real person, although Anne Dieulevieux of France had been a pirate, not a lady. In the 1690s, she was deported to the French Tortugas, now Haiti, where she threatened to shoot Captain Lawrence de Graaf after an insult. The famous buccaneer was so dazzled, or scared, when she pulled out a wheelhouse musket, he got down on one knee and proposed marriage.
"You invented that story," Lydia had laughed. This was at her apartment months ago.
Nope. Research confirmed that Anne Dieulevieux had pillaged and robbed at her husband's side and had assumed command of their ship after de Graaf was struck by a cannonball off Jamaica. Choosing names had been fun. Squabbling about how Lydia knew a forger who sold counterfeit IDs wasn't. The package deal, three sets of Florida driver's licenses with holographs, had cost a bundle. What troubled Leonard was her familiarity with the guy, a seedy canvas of tattoos who'd also offered to include passports at an astronomical price. A felony, yet no big deal as far as those two were concerned. Lydia's mysterious side. This is how he dismissed other troubling episodes, including her odd behavior last night at the resort. She'd refused to remain on a yacht that was as comfortable as the house the owner had described. This was after buying their last silver coin. What the hell? An interesting man, Efren Donner. A filmmaker with a list of credits who also knew a lot about marine archaeology. The man was a little too tall and good-looking for Leonard to feel immediately at ease. But a mojito and conversation had changed that. If Lydia had stuck around, she might have been intrigued by the filmmaker's hospitality, or the transparent duplicity of his offer. Come to his private island, stay for a week or two, then travel by yacht anywhere in the Caribbean, as long as Donner could join their dive exploration. "Maybe getting punched makes me overly cautious," she'd said afterward in the bar, loosening up with a drink and a satchel of cash at her feet. "But, Prof, let's be honest. No one that rich and handsome is interested in me. And I doubt he's got the hots for you. So what's he really want?" She was correct. On the other hand, why not find out what the filmmaker wanted? Aggressive curiosity was new to Leonard. It was testosterone-charged, fueled by recent triumphs yet mitigated by occasional self-doubt. In those moments, he had to wonder if he'd gotten lucky when he punched Purcell. No. The fear in the big bastard's eyes was real. And luck had nothing to do with getting so mad that he had lunged for a bat outnumbered 2-1 by thieves. Last night, almost killing a man had changed Leonard and his outlook to life. If the thief died, he died. Damn right. And good riddance. The same with the job and bitchy wife he'd abandoned. And the stucco house he couldn't afford, all of it. That damn office, bills, 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 a nervous sense of inadequacy, and a beat-up Volvo that personified failure, all gone. The girl was his world now. Sitting in their tiny cabin, he beheld Lydia. She lay naked, asleep, within reach, the warmth of her hair soft on the lips. He dressed and closed the watertight door. Topside, the freighter was alive with folks packing to disembark, and new arrivals. Stop and go, harbor to harbor. It had been like that all day. He did a spin around the deck, flirted with a previous dance partner, then walked aft for a lesson in piloting from his new friend, the captain. A flock of boys caught his attention. Several had wild, spiked hair and ashen skin. They were playing soccer near the railing, too close, it seemed, so he stopped for a while to shield the ball from the water. Nice-looking kids. Good people nearby, who were what they were, nothing more, nothing less, and granted that same freedom to others. Into his mind came the image of Lydia with child. Then another image, Lydia with a child in her arms, on a safe sandy island, water of clearest blue and a boat of their own. In that instant Leonard knew what he'd sensed since arriving in the Bahamas. There was no going back to a life that was beyond repair. He had a new ride. This was his life to savor. Mailboat schedule, fresh moon, Thursday, 6 a.m. departure, Stanley Point, Ordrick Wells, Exuma, Little San Salvador, Sapphire Creek, Arthur's Town, 7 p.m.,
Arrival, plus or minus.
There'd been so many small harbors, piers, and villages of stick and wattle that Lydia didn't know where she was when she awoke to a booming impact. The shudder of reversing engines suggested they'd made the hardest landing of the day. But where? It was nearly sunset, closer to 8 than 7. What she saw through the porthole wasn't a village, and it certainly wasn't Arthur's town. According to brochures, there should have been colorful restaurants, not cresting waves, a distant orb of palms, and a cement house atop a bluff as craggy as bone. The schedule was consulted. If this was Sapphire Creek, the name was misleading. And why had they stopped so far from shore? A scream, then several more pierced the bulkhead. Lydia threw on clothes and ran topside into chaos. Women huddled around a gaggle of weeping boys while men gestured at something in the freighter's wake. Engines clunked into gear, black exhaust screamed whatever was back there as the boat turned into the sun's glare. She struggled to stay on her feet and found a woman she recognized. Twice she had to shout, "What happened?" and finally took the woman by the shoulders. "Did we hit something?" "They gone!" the woman cried, pointing to a section of broken railing. "They was there 1 minute, now they gone. Don't know how many boys." "Oh, my God, can they swim?" "Sea took him. They drowned by now. Been too long in water this dark. Unless Mr. Leon—" A look of recognition came into the woman's eyes. "My lord, you're his wife." "What about Leo? Tell me." Lydia realized she was shaking the woman, so she pulled her close and forced a smile. "I'm sorry, but I need to know. Where is he?" "He gone too, sugar. First one boy, then another. They was kicking at some ball and the railing broke. Mr. Leon was the first to notice, and he almost fell himself. I saw the whole thing. That sweet man, he yelled something and jumped. Didn't wait for the boat to stop. No, he didn't. Just jumped into water so black makes me faint. That's the last anybody seen of him. I know, yes, I do. The sea don't give back what she takes because—" The woman, in shock, continued babbling. Lydia pushed away and ran toward the bridge. The captain was up there with binoculars, braced against a stanchion outside the wheelhouse. He waved directions to someone inside while battling to see through the glare. Nothing in their wake but seagulls and an oil slick, miles long, made by the ship's propellers. Men had organized a sort of bucket brigade, passing life jackets, not water, and throwing them over the side. "Do you see them?" she yelled. "Stop wasting those PFDs until you're sure. Do you hear me?" No response. She kept running. The stairs to the bridge were a series of switchbacks. Elevation magnified the impact of waves and the torque of an old steel hull in a tight turn. She didn't intend on grabbing the captain's arm, but did when the bridge suddenly rolled as she stumbled onto the promenade. "Miss Lydia, what you doing up here, girl?" "I thought you could use another set of eyes," she said. "Where are they?" The captain in his braided cap, elfin-sized and cheery, wasn't smiling when he lowered the binoculars. "What I hope didn't happen was we'd run him over with the props. Don't know, but so far don't see no sign." He resumed his search, adding, "Two fine boys, I was told, and hate to say this, ma'am, your husband, too. I saw him go overboard myself. You ain't gonna faint on me, are you?" Lydia felt a dizzying sense of unreality, but maintained control. "He's not my husband," she said. "We're just traveling together." "That a fact? So it was worry for a friend that brought you running clear up here?" "Yes. No. See, I worked on a commercial vessel for more than a year, and we did a lot of man-overboard drills. If I can help, I want to." "A cruise ship?" "A special service vessel named Diamond Cutter. I wasn't skipper, but went ahead and got my mate's license anyway. But if you don't want me on the bridge, stay put, girl. My eyes aren't what they used to be." Again, a quick glance. He didn't know what to think of this small, bony woman, her cool, detached tone, a little out of breath, but otherwise calm. "Did you see what happened? Reason I ask is I didn't. Maybe you got a better idea of where them boys went in."
"I was asleep. I thought we'd hit something. You weren't on the bridge?"
The little man waved and hollered a change of course to a pane of glass, then spoke normally.
"Your friend, I guess, Mr. Leon, he was at the wheel as they went over. And I'll probably lose my ticket for it. Doing a fine job, too. I don't give a damn what the maritime board's going to say. If he hadn't kept an eye on those boys, jamming us into reverse like he did, they might have been long gone before anyone noticed."
"Wait, Leonard was up here?"
"A woman just told me an entirely different story, that he was here on the bridge, yes, ma'am, at my invitation. If there's 100 souls aboard, you'll get 100 different stories if something bad happens at sea. It's always that way. That's why ships have a log. What happened is, I was in the head, the facilities, so to speak, and when the engines rang into reverse, I come out just as your gentleman friend went over the railing. Lost his balance, I thought, but I know better now.
He jumped?
Mate saw him do it. Don't you worry, Miss Lydia. A man that brave deserves to be found. Them fine boys, too. Here.
He looped the binoculars around her neck.
You look while I get back on the radio. I raise the yacht club at Little San Sal and a private vessel of some kind nearby. They supposed to send more boats and a helicopter.
Lydia, dazed, peered over the railing and had to step back. 30 feet below, a river of water peeled along the hull, churning sargasso weed and froth.
Jesus Christ, she whispered.
Leonard, the fall alone could have killed him. Went after them boys, yes, he did. I'm going to give him my cap once they're all safe aboard. A medal, too, if I had one. You sure you're okay?
She had to pretend she was. When the captain returned a few minutes later, she had the binoculars focused and managed to say,
off the bow, about 200 yards, at 1 o'clock. I see what could be a plastic bag, a log, maybe. Something floating, not swimming. Oh, and there's a hell of a big shark in the area. I got a glimpse of its fin.
The big deacons are always along this ledge,
the old man said, and banged on the glass to get the mate's attention.
Point to what you see, he said.
She did, and the freighter swung a few degrees to the right.
Think it could be something else?
Lydia thought, yes, a body, but said, there's a vessel approaching from the west, maybe the one you mentioned. I think I recognize it from last night at the resort. A private yacht, at least the lines are similar. Want to look?
You point, I'll go back inside and steer,
the captain replied.
The hand signs are something you seem to know just fine.
She waited until the captain was gone, to remind herself that parting with Leonard would have happened anyway. 11. Tamara was in Ford's cottage, showering, when a van with black-tinted windows drove past for the second time that afternoon. The shower window was small, the outdoor pump loud. Water off, she heard the van accelerate, but it turned out to be a plane approaching from the east. Thank God, the biologist was finally back from his meeting with Purcell. It was nearly sunset. A towel and sandals were handy. From the porch, she watched the plane angle low toward the beach, wings like crystal in the harsh light. Then, it unexpectedly banked south along the coast, shrinking smaller and smaller, until trees blocked it from view. That was odd. It was Ford's plane, a blue and white fuselage with big torpedo floats. She'd never flown, but knew that a float plane needed daylight to land on water. The biologist had told her so. Where was he headed? There was nothing south but a dead-end road, then 30 miles of mangroves linked by bays and uninhabited islands. After that, open sea clear to Cuba. Maybe the van had something to do with it. She knotted the towel and walked to the beach for a better angle. No plane, but the sound of its engine was audible over the slow wash of waves. Crazy fools lost, she thought, but knew it couldn't be true. The man was too studious and aware. She had similar doubts about something else on her mind, the claim they were cousins, albeit a second cousin. So what if the biologist had an uncle named Cottrell who had fathered children in the Bahamas? That didn't prove a damn thing. It was Tamara's way of dealing with what might have happened last night if she'd acted on emotions that were still fresh in her mind today. Her alone in the double bed, him on the other side of a door that didn't lock, and a cabin so small she could feel Ford's heat through the wall. Sleeping there was his idea. A safety precaution because of Purcell, supposedly. But she believed it had more to do with the man who'd come around asking about the bald little American, Dr. Nickleby. All because of a stolen logbook? Tamara wasn't convinced this was true either. Not that the biologist would lie to her. He was a rarity, a gentleman. Quiet, solid in his behavior, but at a fun side, despite a wall that blocked what was going behind his eyes. The biologist. That's the way she thought of him, although managed to call him Doc, and a few times Marion, which had a nice, familiar feel rolling off the tongue. Like last night, she'd stepped out wearing the oversized shirt he'd provided, and used his name in a scolding way, saying most decent folks were asleep by midnight, and it was almost 2 a.m., meaning come to bed, which she didn't add because of his startled reaction. It scared her. A cold, cold stare, when he glanced up from a book. Then the coldness was gone, tucked away behind the glare of his glasses. Only then did she notice bedsheets on the couch, and felt like a fool. Her, standing there naked, save for his shirt. The biologist, indifferent to an invitation that was obvious even without being said. As a gentleman, he tried to spare her feelings, which only irritated her. "You look great in that tiger's jersey. Too good for me to wear, so it's yours." He motioned to a chair as he got up. "How about we split the last beer? There's something you can maybe help with." Tamara was unaware the difference between a baggy shirt and a baseball jersey was the name Lamont and the number 22 on the back. "If I can," she said, while he crossed into the little kitchenette. "But first all I meant was it's late. I didn't mean sleep in the same bed together." That got a smile, at least, before he responded, "Don't I wish?" The biologist had a kindness about him. His request for help, she believed, was a contrivance to avoid further embarrassment, even more irritating. He sat her down and explained that he'd proposed to a woman prior to leaving Florida and suspected she might say no. One way or another, the news would come in the form of a letter, the woman in question being the old-fashioned type and a stickler when it came to etiquette. "Did she send you a thank-you card after you got her pregnant?" Tamara asked. A saucy guess, but her instincts were right as usual. The biologist admitted he wasn't sure who the father was, which caused her to say something she regretted. "I'd like to see the etiquette book where that situation's covered." The man was bulletproof, thank goodness. Didn't appear to notice the slight. Nor did he bring up the subject of her late husband and the child she'd lost. So she took it upon herself as penance for the mean remark. "It's easier pretending it never happened," she explained. "And tourists don't want that sadness anyway. I shouldn't have used Dixon as an excuse not to meet you for dinner. That was wrong." "Your son?" "He was 5. The guilt of pretending he's still alive never bothered me before. It is a way of dodging certain situations. Men drunk on vacation, usually, but you're different. I knew it before we found the wreck, and the way you handled Purcell proved it's true. That should make you feel a little better." Perplexed, she stared as the man put his face in his book and pretended to read. "Are you... you're not laughing?" He was. Couldn't seem to hide it. "Not at you. Me. The whole damn human comedy. What you don't know is... well, listen... the woman I told you about, that's all true, she is pregnant, and she'll probably say no. That's why I was out here waiting for you to fall asleep, so I can sleep. Don't you get it?" "Being faithful," Tamara nodded. "No. It's a perfect excuse to climb in bed with someone else. Not that you'd have allowed it, but what a crappy thing to do. Use someone like you, a woman I respect, for what, an ego boost? I asked you to hide out here for a few days so you'd be safe, not to abuse the situation. If it was all a lie, it was the sweetest lie she'd ever heard. That made it difficult to sleep. Images of Marion Ford occupied her mind, the width of his shoulders, his forearms nicely veined, hands that might gently explore, should she allow him to take liberties. And she would allow it, a decision made that morning before the biologist went out for a swim, and before the stranger in his fancy sportsman clothes had revealed her maiden name. Tamara returned to the present as she walked to the water's edge. Where in the world was that pretty little plane? The sound of its engine seemed louder, yet varied with the wind. She waded out a ways and strained to see down the beach. Driftwood, plastic debris from freighters, lined a ridge of high-tide sand. A pot-cake dog, curly-tailed, trotted out from the palms, hiked a leg, and sniffed for crabs or turtle eggs. Offshore was a spine of iron rock that could cut a man to pieces if the sea was up. More rock to the south, where the island curved along a portion of beach and the roof of a red beach house was visible. The stranger in the sporty clothes had claimed he was renting the place. She'd eavesdropped earlier, and planned to accompany the biologist there for drinks after he landed. If he landed. Above a canopy of palms was the most likely spot for the plane to reappear. Pigeons, white-crowned, exploded like leaves into the sunset, spooked by something near the road. Curious, Tamara turned and saw two men coming toward her from the cottage. Official-looking, not tourists, but young and hard, ball caps, slacks, collared shirts, and carrying bags that didn't belong on a beach. That was the first impression, her standing there in only a towel until she realized they wore their caps low as protection from a sun that had already set. Something else. One carried a baton, too large to conceal, although he tried. "We have been looking for you and your friend, Dr. Ford," the man hollered in a strangely formal way. A few steps later, he said, "How'd you like to help the Bahamian government and make some money?" His accent wasn't Bahamian, and he wasn't the Cuban-looking guy who'd asked about Dr. Nickleby. "Wait in your car while I change," she replied, "or come back in half an hour." There was a landline phone in the cottage. Her plan was to lock the doors and call the local constable. The men kept coming, separating in a nonchalant way that was intended to put her at ease, or cut off her escape if she fled north up the beach. "We won't take up much of your time," the man with the baton said. The baton, out in the open now, an electronic-looking device that might have been a cattle prod. Tamara was trying to decide, run or swim. Either way, she'd have to drop the towel. The indignity this guaranteed would be worse if they caught her, a terrifying prospect. In that moment of indecision, a gust of wind brought the sound of a plane landing, baffled exhausts, its engine revving mightily for several seconds, then silence. The man with the cattle prod stopped, looked from his partner to Tamara in mock surprise. "Oh, I didn't realize you are not dressed for visitors. Like you said, we'll come back later." His partner responded, "Yes, let us go find him." Foreigners with strange accents. Tamara bolted the doors when they were gone, and tried to call the constable stationed at Fresh Creek, 20 miles away. The house phone was dead. Perhaps the men had cut the wire. Because of the tin roof, she had to go outside to use her cell, and was told by a woman, "Unless it's an emergency, missy, constable will have to wait till morning." The mole amphib was designed to make long hauls on land and tight spaces. Fully fueled, the 6-cylinder turbo cruised at 130 knots with a range of 600-plus miles. But it wasn't quiet. Engine decibels rivaled an old Huey chopper, which is why Ford banked south, to avoid alerting Jamie Middlebrook or anyone else in houses scattered along the beach. 3 miles of pine flats and mangroves was enough before circling back. He put down in a lagoon south of Mars Bay, killed the engine, and sailed the plane across a mile of shallows until the tide made the tail rudder useless. He waded ashore, rigged lines, and was on the beach in the last tangerine rays of sunlight. Deserted, a curving ribbon of sand. Shorebirds, rocks, and litter. In the far, far distance, an animal, a dog gone feral, curly-tailed, had found a turtle nest. Nearby, birds exploded from the palms. Pigeons, spooky on an island where they were baked in pies. Ford adjusted his bag and walked. Middlebrook's rental was along the way, a red box on stilts, closer to the road than the water. He decided to stop, say hello, and make sure their time wouldn't be wasted later tonight. The house was a typical pre-code beach construct built to rebuild, not to last. The yard was sand, a path outlined with conch shells. Requisite vacation equipage included a pair of cheap kayaks, a grill, and a dented beach bike that lay rusting beneath palms. Out front, a small white Toyota also showed wear. Thousands of the used sedans were imported annually from Japan to augment the Bahamian rental fleet. A few hundred yards down the beach, the same model was parked outside Ford's cottage, if Tamara wasn't using it. Social protocols were in order after butting heads with Middlebrook earlier in the day. He banged politely on the banister and called, "Hello, the house!" Then started up the steps, but stopped. The door was open. Not wide, but enough to invite a cloud of sandflies swarming from the shade. The oversight would have been noticed by someone inside. an internal warning bell began to chime. He backed away for an overview. To the right of the entrance, a window bristled with broken glass, and a section of porch railing was gone. No, it lay in the weeds near the steps. Closer inspection showed a smear of what could be dried blood. Someone might have taken a bad fall. The rental car was worth a look. Keys were in the ignition. On the passenger seat, a bag of groceries, a six-pack of beer, a tub of butter, visible, sat in the late afternoon heat. It was 7 miles of bad road to the nearest store, yet Middlebrook hadn't bothered to refrigerate his perishables. Or was interrupted before he could. Cerebral chimes signaled full alert. Social niceties were dismissed. Ford opened his bag and removed what he needed. Wearing gloves, he went up the steps, nudged the door open, and inspected the kitchen over the sights of a 9mm Sig-Sauer pistol. The pocket version, a P-938, small enough to conceal in one hand if Middlebrook appeared from the bathroom or awoke after sleeping off a drunk. "It's your neighbor," he called through the doorway. "You in there?" Hopefully not. The main room opened seaward to a porch where the rail was missing. The window had been broken from the outside. Glass and a busted screen littered the counter. Furniture was bamboo, one chair was overturned, and a couch had been positioned against the wall as a temporary incline. Two freshly drilled holes in the wall suggested this was so. Remnants of duct tape and a water-sopped floor confirmed it. Cushions would be soaked, too. No need to touch. Ford knew what had happened. The other rooms appeared undisturbed, but there wasn't time for a thorough search. If the people who'd done this hadn't broken into his cottage, they soon would. Tamara was there, alone. The Toyota was tempting. Creating more evidence for police wasn't. And a bicycle would be quieter. He pedaled north on Queens Highway, a regal name for a lane of limestone that tunneled through scrub along the beach. Lots of potholes and sand adrift like snow. Ahead was a blind turn. He slowed at the sound of a car coming fast from the other direction. A van, not a car, with its headlights on in the failing light. The van swerved, skidded toward him on a patch of sand, Ford dumped the bike and looked back. Sat there on his butt and watched the driver's door fly open. When he saw who got out, he grabbed his bag and disappeared into a tangle of vines. "Are you okay, mister? Jesus Christ, that was close." "My leg," Ford hollered in response. "Ah, then you are injured. My leg, goddammit, hurry up." The driver continued calling out apologies as he approached the bicycle. Distinctive, the Germanic accent. Ford synced his movements with the voice while he circled toward the van. Through an opening in the scrub was the road. A man with a flashlight had joined the driver. No need for the light yet, but there soon would be. He was dressed similarly, cargo slacks, a generic ball cap. Both were young, skinny, but soft around the middle, and they wore XL shirts, shirt tails out over polos to conceal the weapons they carried. Tactical types from the look of them, on some kind of job. Maybe badasses, maybe not. But if they hadn't left someone to guard the van, they certainly weren't well trained. Twilight brought the misty weight of fog. Ford used it as a cover. He ducked out from the brush, with pistol drawn, and slid through the open door into the van's driver's seat. He confirmed what was in the back before checking the ignition. The keys were there. Nope, they weren't bros. It meant there was a chance he could scare them into talking and maybe cut a deal. 12. At 9 p.m., Tamara made another call to the constable in Fresh Creek. To her, the disappearance of a biologist with government papers was an emergency. But not to the woman who answered. The constable's wife, most likely. 10 minutes later, Tamara had finished a note to Ford explaining her absence and was going out the door when headlights chased her back inside. It was the van. She slammed the deadbolt shut and retrieved the knife she'd kept nearby ever since her first dealings with the two. The blinds were drawn. On her knees, she crawled to a floor lamp, pulled the plug, and was about to peek outside when a familiar voice called her name. Blinds parted. The van was parked beneath the palms,
and the biologist was almost to the porch. "Turn on some lights," he said. "Bugs about ate me alive out there, and I need to use the head. Come on, we don't have much time."
Tamara ignored the urge to throw her arms around the man and followed him inside.
"Where are they?"
"Who? The ones belonging to that van. Why are you driving it?"
"So you met them. Is one of them the guy who asked about Nickleby? Their accents aren't Spanish, but I understand how you could have—"
"No, that man was scarier. More professional sounding, you know? Those two acted more like big shots. Mean. Their eyes."
Ford noted the fear in her voice. "What did they say?"
"It's what the men almost did. They would have chased me down if they hadn't heard your plane land."
"Are they outside waiting? They're not friends of yours. Can't be thugs like that."
The biologist placed his bag on the table, not angry, but almost.
"Threatened you, in other words?"
"I believe so, yes."
"Bastards.
I had a talk with them. They left out the part about terrorizing you, but trust me, the subject will come up again."
"Did they touch you?"
"Threatened me, that's all. Sort of spread out so I couldn't get away. I was on the beach wearing, well, doesn't matter. One carried a thing looked like a cattle prod. You know, an electric stick farmers use?
A taser.
Yeah, I saw it."
He started toward the bathroom.
"If you don't mind, start packing my stuff, just as a precaution. We'll stop at your place on the way if it turns out you're not safe here. Depends on whether they're willing to come to an agreement."
"Those men? I can't leave. I've got a shop to run. Besides, go where this time of night?"
His voice answered through the bathroom door.
"I'll let you know after I untie those two. I gave them a choice, now it's up to them."
They were in the van when she learned the biologist had left the men in the mangroves after saying, "Think about it." What kind of man tied up thugs rather than go to the police? Tamara fretted while she waited in the van. Was it smarter to get out and run rather than involve herself in bad business like this? It was after 10, late on an island where people match their waking hours to the sun, and much too late to be alone here, parked far from the main road, which wasn't much of a road to begin with. Ford had left her with the doors locked and waded into the scrub. On a headband he wore the scope he'd used earlier, the one that glowed and allowed him to see at night. 15 minutes listening to screaming frogs had seemed like an hour. On the drive, he'd explained that the men had been hired by someone, he didn't know who, to find Dr. Nickleby and the young woman he was traveling with. They're mall cops with some training, but they don't know when to stop. Jamie Middlebrook, the guy we were supposed to have drinks with tonight, they broke into his cottage and waterboarded him, I think. They swear they didn't, but anyway, it's an interrogation technique if done right. Done wrong, it's murder. I have no idea where he is, and you and I were next on their list. They had admitted that much.
That they killed him?
They claim he was gone when they got there. But they damn near killed me. I'd just left his place and they tried to run me over. Somehow I got lucky. They left the keys in the ignition when they came looking for me. I'd crawled into the brush to hide. The door was open, so I climbed in and found a gun in the console. The rest, you're better off not knowing. What Tamara knew was the biologist had lied just as convincingly about his lack of water skills.
"You shot them," she'd said, her tone flat, to suggest that, either way, she wouldn't judge.
"No." He told her he'd left them in the mangroves near where his plane was anchored. Dilly Creek, the area was called, a place where old-timers claimed you could swing a pint jar and catch a gallon of mosquitoes.
"I don't know which is worse," she'd replied, "a bullet or an hour tied up in that swamp. What I'm wondering is why a man who studies sharks and coral disease wouldn't call the police right off. Another stuff, waterboarding, how do you know about such things?"
"I don't expect an answer, but if you were a teacher, it's not biology I think you'd be teaching."
"You might be onto something," was not the reply she expected. He had parked the van and looked at her in a thoughtful way.
"A lesson, I guess that is what I'm trying to do. Like Purcell, there are other ways to turn people around. I promise you this, though. If those punks killed Middlebrook, we'll call police as soon as—"
Tamara had cut him off, saying, "It wasn't no teenager that came after me with a cattle prod or whatever you called it. Half my age is close enough.
So why not give them a chance and maybe get something in return? Like adults tell kids, sure, games are fun until someone gets hurt. That's the lesson for today. I'm not being nice. I want to use what I find out as leverage to make them leave you the hell alone. Earlier, the men had been too cocky to answer questions, even at gunpoint. They knew you wouldn't shoot, Tamara had suggested. Hearing that, the biologist had cleared his throat. They got more talkative when I used duct tape from their own bag. I suspect they took a course or two in security. Now they're so-called private contractors. They probably see it in their heads like a movie, big screen, fake blood. Violence isn't real until it happens to them, which is when the director is supposed to call cut. That's not the way it works. And they'll keep playing the role until they do something really stupid, even stupider than threatening you. Middlebrook, I'm still not sure what happened to him, so I gave them a choice. Like before, Tamara didn't expect an answer, but got an idea of what the choice was when the biologist reappeared from the darkness carrying a flashlight. He motioned for her to lower the window and use the light to herd the men onto the road. It was pitiful the way they stumbled along, their skin and clothes caked in mud. The cockiness had been drained out of them. Probably a few pints of blood, too. Mosquitoes hovered in a haze as one looked at her without making eye contact and mumbled, "Sorry, we won't bother you again." Then asked Ford, in a surly, accented way, "Is that good enough?" "As long as the rest checks out," he replied. "I'll leave your vehicle where you can find her. Sound fair?" "I don't expect to see you two again." "Like we have a choice. What about our phones and equipment? We have much money invested." "Enjoy your walk," was the reply. That was it. On the way back, he said, "They're from the Netherlands. Security guards until they paid an agency to book them as ex-military contractors. No background check, obviously. The dumbasses don't even know who hired them, but their fake bios must have been impressive. A decent chunk of expense money was waiting when they arrived in Nassau. Sloppy work all around. Ever hear of White Torch Limited? That's the company that cut their first check." "What about that man, Mr. Middlebrook?" Tamara asked. "Abducting thugs was bad enough. Murder, she'd have nothing to do with." Ben said, "Thank you," as they turned down a lane where Middlebrook's cottage looked black in the headlights, sea and sky blacker in the distance. The biologist parked, rolled down the window, sniffed the air, and said, "His rental car's gone. No police, that's a good sign, I guess." He opened his bag and got out, wearing gloves, a flashlight in his left hand, and something concealed in his right. "I won't be long. Keep the doors locked." Tamara got out, too, saying, "Waiting gives me the spooks. Besides, I want to see for myself." She trailed him up the steps, careful not to touch anything because he warned it might be used as evidence. The cottage had a Halloween feel, the creaky darkness of it. Room to room they went, guided by the flashlight. "Someone cleaned up. Middlebrook, I hope. His things are gone, even the sort of stuff most burglars would leave behind. Shaving kit, like that. Let's check the bathroom again." They were in the van when Ford opened up a little. "If I was sure he was dead, we'd be in my plane headed for an airport with lights, and those two would still be tied up, waiting for the police. I think either Middlebrook left in a hurry, or a fourth party is involved." "I never saw him before he showed up this morning," Tamara said. "Middlebrook? None of those men." The biologist was silent for a while. "The Cuban-looking guy you mentioned. Do you remember anything else? Some Cubans have a lot of Indian blood. Same with most of us islanders. We didn't talk for long. There was something, a coldness in the way he acted. It's hard to describe. I was thinking more like an Aztec Indian, a guy who might be called that because of his looks."
"I don't understand."
"Or could be there are 5 or 6 or 10 wannabe badasses, all looking for the same thing. If it's not safe here, I'd like to take you along." "Never flown in a seaplane?" She replied, "Being second cousins doesn't mean you owe me anything, even if it's true." The man's glasses glinted in the lights of the dashboard. He was smiling. "Oh? Not to me. There are a lot of Gutrells in the Bahamas." "I'm beginning to believe it. The one I knew was a con artist. People liked him anyway." Ford talked about that, how the behavior of people sometimes confused him. No, mystified him, is the way he put it. Adding, "Especially women."
They loved the old crook. It still doesn't make any sense. The acorn, she murmured. That reference, and the scrub along the road, brought to mind the question he'd posed about White Torch. Is the name of some of those trees along the road?
What is?
The company you asked about. White Torch. There's Black Torch trees, too. I can't tell the difference. That's what they were used for back in the day. Torches. And there's a shoal bridge off Little San Salvador, called that, bits of land that poke up out of the sea, but I've never heard of the company. Isn't there an island in Florida named Torch Key?
Probably because of the same tree. What's it like?
Never set foot there. I mean the islands off Little San Sal, not Florida. That's what I'm saying. White Torch is a long stretch of shoals with only one island that's big enough to chart. It's private. Boats wouldn't stop, not local boats anyway, because the people there don't like outsiders, and they're different.
How so?
I see them on the mailboat. It's partly the way they look. Not big, but great big hands and spiky hair. Red hair, sometimes. They're nice enough, unless you try to set foot on their island. But some say happens, I don't believe, because I'm a Christian.
Really?
He asked a few more questions before saying, maybe they spread the rumors to scare people off. Doubt it. They're scary looking, too. Families there only have two or three last names between them. The Marl people is what they're called. Been that way for hundreds of years, I was told. Have you heard of them? Ford asked more questions before saying,
maybe, in a way.
There was a sociological term, castaway microcultures. He wondered if it applied. In a previous century, he wasn't certain how far back, pirate times most likely, survivors of shipwrecks had settled on the same remote islands that had saved them. After generations of isolation, living off the land and sea, inhabitants had bonded in unique subcultures, tribes, with their own customs and religions. The Maroons of Jamaica were an example. The blue-eyed, copper-haired progeny of the Pinder family on Spanish Wales, Eleuthera, was another. He said, I suppose Marl is the most common family name. I doubt if that's the reason. You know that gray color of clay? Might be why they're called that. Inbred is what some say. Came here in back times from Scotland. A boat carrying witches that Scotland wanted to hang or burn is another rumor. Oh, there are all kinds of stories about White Torch. I never noticed it on a chart. Tamara replied, most don't show a name. It's Marl Landing to Lobstermen. That's all those people do, fish and catch lobster. No tourists. No beach neither, 'cause it's all rock and drops off like a mountain. Others, the old folks, I don't know why, they call the northern point of the island Deacons. The rest of the shoals, what bits of land that are high enough, must be named for the torch trees. The biologist was interested. Stay at my place again tonight. I've got stuff for sandwiches, and you can show me on the chart. Tamara was dealing with those feelings again. In bed alone, in a space so tiny she could feel Ford's presence through the wall, when a distant scream took it all away. A second scream followed, the extended howl of an animal in pain. "Lock up," he hollered from the other room. "Turn out the lights and stay away from windows until I get back." She got a glimpse of the biologist going out the door, shorts, no shirt, boots untied, a gun in his hand. It was a little after midnight. His reading light was still on, and he had yet to put the chart away. What she heard next was so chilling, a simple deadbolt became a complex task. A voice, a man's voice, far away. It shrieked fragmented notes of pain from somewhere inland. Then a single distinct word, "Mama," and went silent. After that, no more silence. Fear the man might scream again tainted the possibility. On the counter was a knife, a folding knife, black carbon. The biologist had left it for her as protection. Despite what she'd been told, Tamara carried it from window to window, peering out after rechecking each lock, then to the bedroom, which had no lock. After 20 minutes, she remembered the constable at Fresh Creek. The landline didn't work. There was no cell reception inside the cottage because of the tin roof. She would have to turn the lights bright and walk outside to make a call. This time, Tamara decided, I'll get dressed first. One of the security guards from the Netherlands was dead. A segment of his body hung from a tree near the van where Ford had left it, doors unlocked, key in the ignition. As a tether, the killer, or killers, had used a shark hook crimped to a long wire leader. It was tackle commonly found on the island. This man hadn't had time to scream. Ford had grabbed only his pistol and a flashlight before running out to do a loop around the cottage. The van's dome light had lured him several hundred yards farther down the road, too far to leave Tamara unguarded, but too close not to look inside. It didn't take long to conclude the second man had been the source of the screams. Not here. Somewhere nearby, and the abrupt silence suggested he was already dead. With the flashlight, Ford searched from the bushes to the tree. What he saw was a ceremonial tableau. Body parts had been posed around a ribcage pendulum. Centered beneath were conch shells, also common on the island. They encircled a mound of viscera that cradled a human heart. Bark from one side of the tree had been slashed out of rage or as the killer's territorial mark. Ford would have moved closer, but the area had been swept smooth with a palmetto frond that now lay at the edge of the road. Instead, the flashlight probed incremental pools of sand. A triangular wedge of shell was within reach. He held it for inspection. A shark's tooth, not a shell. The angle and serrated edge suggested the genus Carcharhinus, but was not conclusive. There were 60 species of requiem sharks and many genera. Ford pocketed the tooth. The surest way to protect Tamara was to intercept the killer. He had to move fast. Sand and limestone were poor archivists when it came to footprints, so he searched for a blood trail. If one existed, it too had been swept away. He returned to the cottage at a run. A siren haze of mosquitoes kept pace. Lights were on, and the front door was wide open. He called her name, going up the porch stairs. Inside, no sign of a struggle. The back door handle came off in his hand, because it was locked. Carrying the night vision lens, he went out the front and ran to the beach. Tamara! Over and over he called her name. A sea wind rustled the palms. Waves slushed over a distant reef of iron rock. Focusing the monocular was no different than adjusting a camera lens. Close focus showed mushy sand along the tide line. Shoes larger than Ford's size, 13s, had exited the water and cleaved a path that trailed north and vanished in the drier sand of a dune ridge. A twist of an optic ring brought a mile of lucent green beach into focus. Staring back from the distance was a man. Tall, big shoulders, too far away for details except for the sheen of his raincoat. No. Possibly a biohazard suit that blood would not stain. And something else. A device the man wore on a headband. It emitted infrared light, invisible to the human eye, but not fourth-generation night optics. A cyclops, one single glowing eye, was the impression. A thermal lens, possibly a camera. In the man's hand was a long-bladed knife. He lofted it overhead, yelled something, and charged. Ford walked toward him at a steady pace, the pistol concealed but ready. It was a strategic error. Killers expect victims to flee, not engage. The man slowed, hesitated, and finally stopped to reconsider. Damn it. Ford noted the 100 yards that separated them. Risk a foot race or try to lure the guy within range. He turned and went the other way to invite pursuit, which is when he finally heard Tamara calling from the water. Indistinguishable, her words, but she was in distress, possibly hurt. It took another focus adjustment to locate her head bobbing midway between the beach and the reef. "I'm coming!" he yelled. Maybe the killer heard this as a threat. Ford watched him escape inland and abandon any hope of pursuit. He holstered the pistol and waded out. Tamara was fully dressed, shivering, but okay. "Wait until we're inside," he told her. She was sitting with a cup of hot tea, a blanket around her, while the biologist alternately checked windows and listened. Tamara had left the porch to call the constable, and had surprised the man as he crossed the yard toward the road. "I don't think he was looking for me. It was the way he reacted, but I was so scared I ran. Get to the water, like this morning with those other two. That's all I could think about. Good thing, because when I looked back, he was on the beach, wading in after me. He had a knife, a sword, we call them, so I kept swimming. Even after he was gone, I stayed out there, waiting for you. Who is he?
Did you get a close look?
It was dark, and I was so scared. I knew it wasn't you. I hadn't dialed the constable yet.
Ford said, I think someone's killing off the competition. Hang on a sec. What did that mean? He went out and returned a few minutes later, saying, we're good. Whoever the guy is, pathology's involved. Or religion. It's hard to hang a tag on manic behavior. Middlebrook warned me that anyone looking for Nickleby is in danger. I should have listened. Now we have no choice. We have to get the police involved.
Middlebrook, that's who was...
No. The two guys I left in the mangroves, one of them, that's who we heard. A warning hand discouraged questions. You don't want to know what happened to him. Probably the other one, too. Shit. The biologist clubbed a fist against his thigh.
You're not blaming yourself.
Not as the cause, but for the results. If I hadn't tried to teach them a lesson, they wouldn't have been on foot, unarmed, when he ambushed them. Yeah, one's dead, the other... I can't just go off and leave until I'm sure, so while I search, you'll stay in the car. The rest can wait until we're on the plane. Tamara wanted to fly out with him, but didn't want to appear too anxious.
Like I said, you don't owe me anything, and I have a business to run.
It's the slowest time of year for tourists, the biologist reminded her.
So why not?
I'm meeting a friend in a couple of days on Cat Island. Thomason, the guy I said wrote a bestseller. You'll like him. 13. Tomlinson caught the Lady D out of Nassau, a 14-hour mail boat fest to a casino resort near Spanish Wells. He appreciated art. The pool was resplendent with sculpted silicone breasts, but rich husbands gave him the willies. Time to move on. Governor's Harbor. He attended a drum circle at Bamboo Point. Feral cattle, abandoned by conquistadors, grazed with indifference as rum-key locals led him into a cave adorned with Lucayan petroglyphs 1,000 years old. No one had seen a short, bald American traveling with a woman who might be using the name Lydia Johnson. Several stops and 2 days later, he was on the docks north of Arthurstown, Cat Island, when a familiar seaplane flew over. Wings wagged hello. The amphib banked east toward Little San Salvador, a speck on the horizon 12 miles away. "That there's the deacon coming to collect," said a man cleaning fish. Its words were a melody of percussive notes. "That there's the deacon coming to collect."
"The pilot?" Tomlinson replied. "Uh-uh, he's a pal of mine. To get him in church, there'd have to be an aquarium behind the pulpit. Or a commie. Back to what I was saying, Dr. Nickleby's kind of a small, uptight dude, bald. Probably wears—" "No," the man interrupted. "Out yonder. That there's the deacons, I mean. See him?"
The cleaning table was built over a creek that pushed a stream of indigo through shoals of copper and jade. An outgoing tide flushed seaward, where water blackened hundreds of feet deep. A shadow appeared. It resembled a torpedo, snaking up from the depths. Several shadows followed, a slow serpentine parade.
"Holy be Jesus," Tomlinson said. "Sharks. I was swimming here not an hour ago. Had to wash my hair."
"Looks nice, too," the man replied. "I like the bandana. Red's okay. Me, I'd select green if you're regular in your bathing habits. The deacons come calling, they less likely to eat a man who resembles a bush."
He was cleaning snapper and big bull dolphin, mahi mahi, that lay glistening in the sunlight. The knife freed skin from vertebrae. The head was severed. He flung the carcass, a cloud of gulls trailing it down as it smacked the water. Shadows turned. The surface erupted. A scythe tail stirred a sustained explosion while the shadows tumbled in a glassine gel. The gel's clarity showed sharks large enough to snap off a man's leg. Beyond the shoals, a semicircle of fins sprouted. Fins converged beneath seabirds that hovered and dived for tidbits, quarrelsome as hyenas while the water boiled.
"Deacon, he collect tithes for the gods of deep salty," the man explained. "As the book says, every man give a tenth of his wealth, and blessed he shall be. I wouldn't expect a modern person such as yourself to understand."
Tomlinson replied,
"Here's another one.
each according to his heart, give ye not grudgingly, for God loveth a cheerful giver.